This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Ithaca, New York boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation among 150 waterfalls. Plan your trip today with help from visitithaca.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, where a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Tracy Brandt. We'll talk to Tracy about women and wine, natural wine, and donkey and goat. We'll taste the 2017 Eliza for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben-Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Tracy Brandt moved away from a career in tech towards a love and interest in wine. Tracy and her eventual husband, Jared, took a wine sabbatical in France and had the opportunity to work under the tutelage of famed winemaker Eric Texier. They returned to California to continue a life in wine, helping to pioneer the low-intervention natural wine movement there. Their winery is Donkey and Goat in Berkeley, California. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Tracy.
Thank you.
All right, Tracy, I want you to give our listeners a little context of who you are. I had mentioned that you'd come from the tech world. So take me from the tech world and how and when things in your life morphed into wine from there and the creation of Donkey and Goat, which means get us to the current.
Sure. So I'm going to back up slightly. So I came from North Carolina to California in 98 on an advertising career and quickly decided that technology was too exciting. So I kind of jumped ship and landed at a .com where I met Jared. And we started, I was already, of course, drinking wine, but I hadn't entertained the idea of making wine. Jared was a little bit more interested in learning the mechanics. And as we started to vacation in the coming years, we were typically headed to Europe and traveling through the Rhone Valley or Burgundy and just becoming more and more kind of passionate and, you know, really interested in what was going on in the cellar. So 9/11.
The cellar more than the field?
Well, the cellar and both.
Okay.
But at the time, there was kind of this idea brewing really in Jared's head that he would take a sabbatical and go work a harvest and learn kind of how to make the wine, which seemed a little bit more approachable because he only had about 3 months to give versus doing the entire growing season. So fast forward to after 9/11 and our individual startups were kind of no more. We decided to take a pause. You know, we've both been at it for about 10 years. We're a little burnt out. And we were dating at the time and started thinking about the idea of doing something in Europe. And this was, you know, 8 years before Instagram, 4 years before Facebook. So there was no real visual in our face as to what this actually would be and look like and feel like. You know, we're 30-somethings deciding to take a pause. So it was a little unusual, at least in our circle of friends. And even when we went for it, we were a little taken aback after we were about 6 months in to find out we were too old to get the stage visa in France because
really?
As a plus 30-year-old, it was not available.
That's funny.
But yeah, so basically it started a little bit of a kind of a research, you know, what wines were interesting, who were their makers, how would we go about finding them and connecting with them, and that led us to, you know, zeroing in on Eric Texier and talking to Joe Dresner, and ultimately sending a fax, because this was also before email was as prevalent as it is today.
Certainly texting, too.
There was no texting. I had a flip phone.
That's right.
So we literally fax Eric and Laurence, and they wisely tell us that they would want to meet us before agreeing to have us come and stay with them for an extended period of time. So, again, this is, you know, post 9/11, and Priceline was quite the thing. So we bid on two tickets to Paris from SFO on a Wednesday for a flight on Friday for $300, and we get it. So we hop a plane, we go meet the taxiers. We like each other, and they decided to let us come. So a couple months later, we sublet our San Francisco apartment and moved to France.
And so you literally pack bags to stay there for a little while. He takes you in. You got to go back and settle, and then you go back, or?
We only went for a weekend to meet and greet and literally came back.
And then
and then returned.
The extended tutelage and all of that.
Exactly. We went back in May of 2002. So we, I have to say, compared to what I do with my own Harvest interns, it was a lovely way to get started, because we had from May until August to get to know Eric, Laurence, the team, the cellar, to rack wines and really learn in a very different rhythm than the Harvest rhythm, which was quite lovely.
All right, so you finish that. You come back.
So we came back in 2003.
Sort of permanently. Like you left there to come back to settle, right?
We came back. Well, San Francisco was where our apartment still was. So Right. We came back and honestly at the time expected to kind of go back into our, you know, lucrative tech jobs and figured, you know, we would at some day diverge our path back to wine. But we are both big believers in hands-on education and figured if we really wanted to solidify all that we learned, we needed to make some wine and we needed to apply it without having Eric right there to answer all the questions and such. So 2003, we go and convince a friend to turn his Potrero Hill basement into a little cellar. And we then go and find several vineyards that were willing to sell us some fruit, and we make 6 barrels of wine.
So you start right away. Did you feel there was an immediacy? Like, if we don't do it now, we'll forget or we won't get to it? I mean,
well, that was kind of
part
the point.
Of it?
Was definitely to, you know, we had been given a very, in-depth and intense, because 2002 was a really difficult year in their own education, but we wanted to apply it ourselves, you know,
right.
Make wine ourselves. And so that was the idea of 2003. But the reality is once we got into it, you know, like many, we kind of couldn't resist taking it forward. And in 2004, we decided we had a couple opportunities happen and started a company, named it Donkey and Goat, and made our first commercial vintage.
So we're leaving kind of a big part out here, and I guess it's a good time for you to talk about what influences Eric Texier had on you.
Sure.
You know, what you learned, how he did his business, and what that meant to you, and how you do your business, which is making wine. So, you know, tell me a little about what Eric's philosophy was, why that's important to you, and when you got here, what your goals, you know, were as far as how you wanted to make wine moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, when we, I mentioned that there was some research. So we were, you know, we were already kind of narrowed down to looking at, you know, particular farming methods and particular, you know, cellar methods. We didn't totally appreciate the natural wine movement, if you will. We were well aware of Eric's philosophy of farming, and we loved his wines for their purity, for their electrifying acidity. We appreciated the breadth with which he was operating and the fact that he, like us, had not left high school straight into a cellar, but rather he, you know, had gone off and had a career as a material scientist for decades before
Right.
he decided to make wine. And here we were in our 30s, you know, kind of, you know, thinking a similar divergent path. When we got to France, it was there that we really better understood that there was you know, kind of philosophy beyond the soil. And it's not to say that the farming isn't pivotal and really the foundation of natural wine, but the lack of continuity to bottle was what was kind of the disconnect for many, especially in America, but also in Europe, where you would have organically farmed or biodynamically farmed grapes brought into a cellar, and then more of a conventional method would take hold where you would, you know, eliminate all the microbial activity with sulfur or lysozyme, and then you would add back cultured yeast, and you would use new oak, and you would filter and fine, and all these things that were really kind of at odds with the idea of farming microbes, which is kind of pivotal to natural wine. So that was really the big aha for us with Eric, was realizing that it needs to go from soil to bottle and not just, you know, stop once you get the grapes off the vine.
Right.
You
said you prescribe to continuity from soil to bottle.
Absolutely.
Not, it goes all the way to the end.
It absolutely.
And that's low intervention practices.
It is lower intervention practices. I think by just as a result, I think, you know, we don't set up to say it has to be low intervention. It's rather, you know, we want to, again, you know, focus on, you know, a soil that is alive and what that's going to mean for the resulting grapevine and the resulting grapes. And then, you know, take that into the cellar and continue to kind of steward it. And we definitely have things we do that, you know, mask terroir, if you will. So we do skin contact whites in several wines, and that is not necessarily going to be a direct representation of what that varietal would do
right. Without
that.
Right.
Carbonic maceration also, I mean, it's another example of that. But really trying to not use...
What would you call those? Are those are not manipulations, they're techniques, or are they both?
I don't know. I mean,
I get your point, and you're right.
It's semantics a little bit. I don't worry too much about. There are some people that would say that, you know, you're not making terroir-driven decisions if you're doing those things. For us, I don't know. We want to be, mindful of what we're doing, both to kind of soil or planet and our health. So that, you know, pretty much eliminates petrochemicals from both the cellar
and
the soil.
That's really the mission.
That is our mission.
Good for us, good for the earth.
Let's eliminate glyphosate in my lifetime. I mean, that would be a very big goal.
All right, so help me with this, because I've been wrestling with the term natural wine for a while on the show with guests, different points of views. And I'm not looking for you to give me the definition. I'm just looking for you to give me your explanation or what natural wine is. I know we talked about it a little. And is even that the right term?
I have sat down over the years with multiple people and argued the word natural, especially in America, is not the right term. In 2010, we poured at Vin Natur at Villa Favorita, which is one of the natural wine fairs outside of Vin Italy. And we came back just, you know, all excited and wanting to tell anybody who would listen that, you know, we were the only American winery to pour there and how exciting that was. Natural wine this, natural wine that. And no one knew what I meant when I was saying natural wine. And the people that, you know, actually would at least entertain me were like, what does that word mean? And it's true. It's completely abused in the food industry in America, you know, and
go
it's unregulated.
Supermarket. It's on everything.
Exactly.
Crap.
Absolutely.
Natural crap.
It is wholly misused. But it is the word that the Europeans had started using, back in 2006 and 2007. And, you know, so as people in America started making wine in the same manner and sort of becoming part of this global community, there just really wasn't an opportunity in my mind to change the word at that point, and certainly to have a community with two words, one for America, didn't really make sense either. So, you know, for better or worse, it is called natural wine. It definitely is a lightning rod for discussion and debate as to, well, isn't everything natural, or it's such a misused word. But You know, for us, it's, you know, we've been making wine since 2004 for Donkey and Goat, and not until about 2015, 2014 did we start talking about our wines as natural wines. We haven't changed what we do. We've done the same from day one.
That's typical of Europe, too. I mean, winemakers in the Loire, they farm naturally and they vinted, you know, naturally, and, you know, they didn't call it anything. Now it's a big thing. You did that from the start.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, we have to put parameters and names around what we're doing in order to convey to others to have some common understanding.
We'll talk about that. So I guess you're leading towards organics, biodynamics, sustainability. Is that what you're pointing towards?
Well, sort of. I mean, ideally, I think there would be, at the very least, you know, a charter or something to define. You know, I've talked to a number of people about that, and I don't know if it will happen. But for us, yeah, I mean, in the vineyards, you know, we, like I said, we're farming microbes. We want soil that's alive. We're not, you know, using glyphosate or Roundup in anything. And we don't think anyone should. We are not always certified. Some of ours are Demeter certified, biodynamic, some are organic certified, some are practicing organic. And, because of our involvement, we're okay with not being certified. I understand the value of that for the consumer, but, it's also, you know, not always a perfect solution when it is just within the box of organic farming.
Explain something. You don't own vineyards.
No,
so we
don't
work
own land.
With farmers and contract, but you have a bar that you want them, you know, to live up to.
Yeah, well, back to one of your earlier
which
questions,
which is what you're alluding to.
One of the things that we definitely took away from Eric was the you know, absolute single most decision we can make is who we're going to work with from a farming perspective, and to spend, you know, all the time necessary to find the right partners. And we do that. So we don't go into a vineyard and say, hey, we want you to get off the Roundup. We go into a vineyard that's already
not using it.
Right. and doing things that, you know, we want to do, or growing things we want to grow, or willing to work with us to plant new things. So like in El Dorado, where we've been since 2005 with Ron Mansfield, he and his son Chuck are the only ones that farm for us up there. And, you know, the wine we're going to taste was planted by us and Ron at a vineyard that Ron leases. And in the other Appalachians, Mendocino, Napa, Sonoma, we have more vineyard grower-specific sites. But still, you know, we're in it for the long haul. You know, we're not just going on the market every year and trying to buy some fruit. So we are kind of, we're not directing, because the people we work with are well equipped to do what
they don't need
my two cents.
So El Dorado is in the Sierra Nevada?
Yeah, 2,600 to 2,800 foot elevation, vineyards on granitic soils, all peppered around the American River. So very reminiscent of the Rhone Valley, which is what led us up there.
Right, and Eric Texier was a Rhonist, and that was a
exactly.
big influence. You said Mendocino. You said Napa.
Mendocino, we went to the Anderson Valley initially to find some very cool climate Syrah, which we did at the Broken Leg Vineyard. Worked with Steve Williams for years before he died, and later expanded to other vineyards in that appellation as well as surroundings, so Mendocino County, Mendocino Ridge. And then more recently, we started working with Steve Mathiason at Linda Vista, and we also get a little Cabernet from Steve. And then we have a new project in Sonoma with some Pinot Meunier.
Okay, so you're pretty much all over the place.
Yeah.
So you started with an eye towards Rhone varietals, because you were with Eric in the Rhone, and
we had fallen in love with the Rhone.
Your initial wines skewed
absolutely
heavy.
I mean, you know, Raymond Troyer was an early love of ours. You know, the breadth of opportunity within the Rhone. So we kind of had our business head on thinking, well, we don't want to make everything. Oh, but if we go with Rhone, we get, you know,
right,
a huge breadth and depth of opportunity to stay within, you know, the box, if you will, of Rhone varietals. So there we stayed for about 5 years until we really started branching out, to your point, of doing a lot of other things.
So your first 5 years, you stayed true to the Rhone. And you know, if you look on the website or you look on a in a wine store at a shelf, the amount of grapes that you vinify now.
It's staggering.
It is staggering. And what's the right word? Not motivation, but what's the reason you want to keep making wine with other grapes?
Well, I mean, it's certainly not probably the best financial decision. You know, the best financial decision would
check
be to make
that box off. No.
No, yeah, to make, you know, three or four wines and a lot of them. But, you know, this is our labor of love. So there's passion, there's, you know, intellectual curiosity, you know, there's just kind of staying a challenge. So we evolve. We become interested in different things. We have wines that we taste that inspire us to go after, you know, making something in that realm.
So that's the genesis. So people own property. They go, you know what? We're going to clear this little plot and grow a little Pinot Gris. That's not you because you don't own it. So what's the reason? You taste something. You want to try it. So you'll look for...
Exactly.
Somebody like, who's planned. Tell me how that comes about.
You know, it's a multitude of ways. So with the Pinot Gris that I make, that was more, you know, I was interested in making it. I wanted to make it in concrete and have it have some skin contact. And that meant that I wanted to have a vineyard that was going to provide me Pinot Gris that, you know, maintained a level of acidity, because when you put it on the skins, you are going to reduce your acidity a little bit and have a higher pH. So that kind of immediately sent me more North Coast than El Dorado, if you will, and started asking who's got, you know, organic biodynamic Pinot Gris, and there's just not that much out there.
Right.
And, you know, that led
small brotherhood
to Filigreen Farm, and, you know, there I've been since 2014, and very happy, yeah.
So that's how it comes about.
That's how it comes about.
So through the years, how many different grapes have you made wine from? Got to be dozens, right?
Oh.
Dozen and a half, two dozen?
Probably more than two dozen. Yeah.
We'll get into that in a second. Before I get into Donkey and Goat and specific wines and all that, I just wanted to get your take on being a woman in the wine business. you were a woman in the tech business. We talked about morphing into the wine business. Was being a woman in the business when you started, was there any disadvantage or negative effects on you trying to build the business being a woman?
I mean,
you had Jared, but let's put that aside.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think one of the interesting things in the last, you know, few years, you know, I'm old enough to have been part of the generation of women that, you know, maybe didn't consciously recognize all of the biases because they were so pervasive. And I've always been kind of a can-do girl, you know, just roll up my sleeves. And I mean, my mom ingrained that in me early on. Like, you can pretty much do whatever you want. You just got to
work through
hard.
That.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is crazy, right?
And, you know, I did. And since, you know, all of the Me Too movement and just the open dialogue that's been occurring, and I have two daughters, you know, there's been moments where I'm like looking back at my career and, you know, pretty big transgressions here and there that just hadn't even entered my consciousness in decades. As far as the wine part goes, you know, yeah, there were years and honestly, there still are occasionally where the assumption is that I must be in the office doing the books or, you know, not possible could I actually be in the cellar.
Still get that.
Doing the, oh, absolutely.
It's like female psalms. They come to a table, they go, can you send the psalm
can
over?
You send the psalm? Yeah, exactly.
You still feel that?
Not as much. But certainly it still occurs, yes. And, you know,
so
I think it's
it
just
then,
a bias.
Still feel it now. But never got so far in front of you where you couldn't do what you wanted to do.
No, but there's definitely some, you know, it's just, it's like in any industry. So I'm in the market doing a visit and, you know, all the male winemakers and male sales reps are going to carry on for, you know, hours. And I'm not invited to go because I'm a woman. And maybe
Is
that's
that for
awkward.
Real?
Of course it's for real.
Really?
You know, and so there's definitely still, I think...
I would have thought in New York, and I've interviewed a
lot
of these
people. Well, I'm not saying
people.
That it's New York,
No, I
but...
know what you're saying. The fact that it even exists or you're talking about it a little, I didn't even think...
Well, and again, I don't know that it's necessarily... I mean, I'm a pretty open-minded person, so I'm not saying that anyone is, you know, maliciously saying don't invite Tracy Brandt.
No,
she's
no,
a female, but it's like
it that way.
You know, hey, me and the boys.
It's easier
are
not
go here.
It's easier not to have you there.
And well, it's not even that. It's just like me and the boys are going to go over to the bar, and it turns out, you know, one of the boys is, you know, a very important wine buyer, and the other boys are winemakers, and they get to, you know, basically provide connections that will eventually lead to sales. And because I'm a woman not invited, I lose out on that. And that's, you know, that's just reality. I mean, the flip side now, I think, is now there's so much focus that maybe there's going to be, you know, in the coming years, women going out without inviting the men to come to the bar.
It's starting to happen.
You know.
It's starting to happen. I mean, the last question in that set was, are women getting their props? And you sort of answered it. You're in a market trip today. You know, you're importer, distributor, Jenny and Francois, they're doing a portfolio tasting next week. You're in the market to talk to people, and that stuff's still going on. So,
yeah,
I know
I think
you're
it's
not
a lot
whining,
better.
And I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm really just trying to put a light that in the wine business, there's still, you know, issues with women, and I think, you know, you
I think there's been a huge spotlight in the last couple of years, which, you know, is definitely making it more difficult to keep it in the shadows.
Right.
And
that's
also making people that are, you know, inherently, again, not doing it maliciously, is just an ingrained bias aware. So I do think change is happening in a good way.
That's good.
And I'm optimistic for my daughters.
All right. So we'll move along. Yes, hopefully you are optimistic and it'll be an even better world for them, because it's a good world, but let's make it better. So you've been at this, a little under 20 years. In all the years of making wine, I mean, what have you really learned and what have you changed? I mean, we talked about adding grapes because you get intrigued. What about the product, making it better, you know, the commitment towards natural? I mean, anything that really comes to mind? Your philosophy? I mean, I know that.
Well, I think the biggest thing is, I mean, certainly, you know, in the early years, it was harder to trust our instinct, whether it be a picking decision or, you know, a winemaking decision or an evaluation of something that, you know, might seemingly present as a flaw but would actually work itself out just because it's like a stinky fermentation and give it some time.
But that's so, know as you grow. You know more as you do more.
Exactly.
And as you grow.
For sure.
So you need a time out in the field and in the cellar.
Exactly. And more experience, more historical evidence that, you know, of what
like
worked and what didn't work.
You're not as caught up on metrics. You just sort of said that. It's how it tastes, the brightness, the acidity.
We're definitely not focused on metrics. Like, and we've never published our pH and TA and all the things that some winemakers publish with their wines, because we think there's an inherent judgment. And our pHs will run high sometimes. And if there's a balance in the wine, you know, we're okay with Syrah at 3.8 or 3.9. And, you know, there are winemakers who say, no red wine could ever be over 3.6. It would be unstable. And you're like, well, ours are, but we don't want you to judge by the numbers. We want you to taste and decide if you like it.
So it's more about not sulfites or no sulfites or alcohol levels or acidity. It's what's dealt to you, what you like, and how you want it to come out in the bottle. Fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think more or less fair. You know, we definitely tend to have wines that result in lower alcohol. And our wines have trended down, and some of that is just the way California vintages have evolved, and some of that is, like I said, we gained confidence after the first 3 or 4 years to push pick dates or push growers, really, and growers stopped giving us a hard time. You know, when we were starting out, there was growers that would question our sanity for picking.
Tell people why you would want to pick earlier.
So we like to pick to talk about metrics. We're watching acid more than sugar, and we're tasting. So, you know, phenolic ripeness and flavors are paramount, but
isn't everyone measuring bricks? You're right. Watching the acid.
We measure
bricks.
They have
a little thing looking at, but they're obsessed with that.
Yeah, so we don't ever take the refractometer into the vineyard. We just taste, because we feel like we get a biased judgment if we're looking at the numbers. we taste, we sample, we get back to the winery, then we run the metrics, and sometimes we're surprised and sometimes we're not. But what we're trending or tracking, the trends are on the acid, because we have some ability to manipulate our acidity vis-a-vis blending. So we've planted a lot of Pickpull, for example, over the years, which we use as a natural blender to raise acidity in the whites. We do the same with Grenache or Grenache Gris on the reds. But you can't manipulate it that far. So pick date is really, really critical if acidity is important, which it is for us. The other two things for our wines is we always are also kind of focused on texture. So whether it be white or red, we like to
what
have some texture.
So people go, okay, I get it. But I'm drinking a wine, Tracy, tell me when I'm drinking it, what am I noticing?
Some of it can be a tannin, right? So like my Skin Contact Roussanne has loads and loads of texture through the chewy tannins on the mid palate. Sometimes you can get texture from certain varietals, like the wine that we've got here today included some planting. It was a kind of a purposeful field blend, but we planted Grenache Blanc and Vermentino with three other varietals because those could lend some layers in the mid palate, so the perception of texture, if you will, within the wine. You can get it from stem inclusion sometimes as well. So it depends, or batonnage. Sometimes you can add some layers into your Chardonnay if it feels a little thin.
So every available opportunity, whether it's blending grapes, stem contact or not, that's what's available to you.
That
not adding acid or, you know, that purple crab. That's how you make the wines to the texture, balance, and acidity that you want, right?
Yeah. And the last one I was going to mention, too, is vat. So we recently, last couple of years, started working with clay. And clay is far more permeable than, say, oak or our concrete tanks that we also work with.
Is clay the same as amphora?
Yeah.
So it's an amphora style thing.
Not shape, but yes.
But material.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And they're made in Italy. And those lend even more texture because there's more oxygen into the vat, the wine, during the fermentation or the aging, which opens it up a little bit.
So when I ask, what have you learned? You've learned that by going to clay gives, right?
One of the many things, yeah.
So is the majority of wines you're making in clay or?
No, we're still probably majority in oak. But we use oak, both barrel, and we have several large Terrence Oak Cuve upright tanks. We have some Nombleau concrete. We have the clay. We do a few things in stainless. What we don't do and what we've never done, and I think we're somewhat unique, is we have never fermented or aged in plastic, and we never will.
And that's us why.
Well, back to my earlier statement that I feel I will get on the soapbox and get quite dogmatic on the need of the industry to divorce from the petrochemical industry, whether it be soil or cellar. And, you know, we definitely have some plastic tools around, but we definitely have never entertained the idea of fermentation in plastic.
So typically, if you visit a winery and you go in the winemaking area, there's these huge
pick bins,
plastic
yeah.
pick bins, and even the grapes fermenting, you know, with in plastic bins too.
And there's
right?
plastic totes that some people will age in. And yeah, I mean, and a lot of it's a cost decision. And, you know, so I don't, I don't try to be too obnoxious about faulting others for their decisions. But like for us, when we started out, we decided to the cheap route to not using plastic was to find a bunch of used Hungarian oak puncheons. They're half ton upright wood vats, and we turned 18 or 20 of those into our fermenters for the first many years. That's all we had.
Interesting. So at Donkey and Goat, you make all these different wines. They're all relatively small runs, right?
Relatively. We have a couple now. Gadabout and Gallivanter, we make about 1,200 cases. And those are our kind of...
For you, that's a lot.
That's a lot. That's a whole lot, right.
But I mean, we're talking 150, 250, 350 on some of these other wines too,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
In a given year, let's talk about 17, go back to 16. How many different wines are you going to put in the market?
Okay, so we make on any given year somewhere between 25 and maybe 28 wines.
Different bottlings.
Different bottlings.
Available for the consumer.
Not all of those are distributed, but okay. Yes, we have.
But they're bottled. They're made and bottled.
They're made and bottled, and about a quarter go to our wine club and, okay. and nowhere else.
So that's important because your wine club's the consumer. It's just exactly. your, you know, immediate consumer. So talk about the wines you just mentioned. Those are the larger runs, right?
The Gadabout and the Gallivanter? Yeah. So those are two wines that we started making in about 2014.
Fairly recently.
Yeah, no, for sure. They are both kind of, they're blends. They're loosely based on what I kind of call the fighting varietal. So the white's a Chardonnay and the red is a Merlot. But they take, you know, a host of other things that are in our cellar that honestly don't wind up elsewhere in the kind of, in the main event. Absolutely.
Right.
It's a way for us to, you know, have a home for things and make a delicious by the glass, you know, $20-ish dollar wine. That's still grown the same way and made the same way. So it's not a second label. It's not made offsite, you know, which, you know, right. it says a lot, I think.
You're making a pet nat. You've been making it for years.
We're one of the first domestic pet nat makers. We started, the first experiments were in 9 and 10.
Okay. That's not that long ago.
No,
but being the first, it just shows you how
new everything is.
Yeah, in the States at least.
Absolutely.
Because what's cooler than popping a pet nat at a dinner or a party? Right?
I did it last night.
It's the perfect,
It's fantastic. So yeah, no, the Lily's pet nat, which is our oldest running, the first vintage was 11, and it's a Chardonnay from the deep end of Anderson Valley that is so acidic. Not until this year did I ever make a still wine out of it. But
There's
it's largely
Chard?
No, it's a skin contact Chardonnay okay. for the wine club. From
the
same vineyard.
Is the pet nat always the Lilies?
There's several pet nats.
Okay.
The one we distribute and is huge production at 420 cases.
Okay.
Is the Lilies, yes.
Okay. And you make a rosé, and you've even gotten off the Rhone and other interesting grape things, like you said, making Merlot and a Cab every now and then.
Yep.
Right? But is the wheelhouse still the Rhone varietals?
I think so. I mean, it's still definitely 45-ish percent of what we make, maybe 55
okay.
in some years. And we still have, you know, several, I don't know, probably six, maybe seven, eight wines that are Rhone varietals, maybe more.
Okay.
I'd have to add it up.
Let me see what I have here. One, two, three, four.
Yeah, we probably have.
Yeah,
no,
there's
a lot.
Yeah. All right, a couple more things, then we're going to take, quick break, and I want to subject you to our wine list. You're probably one of the few people that wrote a manifesto about what you're doing or what you want to do or what we should be doing or what we should aspire to or what other people should be doing. And we talked a lot about some of those aspects and all that. You wrote that, I think, 10 years ago. I think it was 2009.
It was.
And 2009 doesn't seem that long ago again.
It was a different world, though.
So to answer two things. What inspired you to sit down and write this manifesto? And it wasn't two paragraphs. And how is it holding up now as far as what you're doing, what you continue to aspire to do?
So the first question, in all honesty, it was a rant. It was harvest okay. of 2009. After midnight, there was a wine buyer in the Bay Area with a sizable amount of buying power, if you will, several restaurants, that was, I thought being irrational on some of his reasons for not taking our wine. And one of them was our alcohol. And so
Too low?
No, it was too high.
It was
so
too high.
One of our wines from 2008 was 14.1. And, you know, as a natural winemaker, we have never manipulated our alcohol. So, yes, our alcohol is our alcohol. It's a decision of pick date.
That's how that came out.
But we don't water it, and, you know, we're not doing a reverse osmosis treatment, so it is what it is. And so I went on a kind of a tirade, you know, being tired and angry and whatnot, and wrote, that was an email that has been almost exactly reprinted. I think there's been like two or three minor edits And Jared basically, this was back in the day, we had a blog. And so Jared basically copied and pasted my email onto the blog. He was like, this is a great manifesto. And later on, we took it and put it on the website as a manifesto. But it really was just a very, you know, honest reaction to something someone had said and saying, this is everything we do. And last fall, actually, I had someone ask me to reread it.
It's not like an old yearbook picture. You didn't cringe. It all made sense, right?
No, it definitely still makes sense. There's a couple things. You know, I said that it was impossible. As something like my French friends would say, it was impossible to make lower alcohol wines in California, which, of course, is not true. And then I said something about we only ferment in wood and stainless because we didn't have concrete and clay at the time, but the no plastic thing still stands.
That's more of a thing.
You evolved into clay,
which, you know, is ancient and all of that. So if you want to see that manifesto, just go to the Donkey and Goat website. Tracy, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you a few questions for our wine list, and then I got to get you out of here. We're also going to taste one of your wines. We're talking to Tracy Brand from Donkey and Goat. You're listening to The Grape Nation. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Located in New York's Finger Lakes region, Ithaca boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation. As the saying goes, Ithaca is gorgeous. The city is home to 150 waterfalls and gorges sprinkled through its downtown and sloping hillsides. State parks and acres of natural lands offer outdoor recreation for every level of enthusiast. Come stroll among the cool ravines, scenic hiking trails, and natural vistas. Ithaca is home to Ivy League Cornell University and Ithaca College, resulting in an influx of new cultures, new tastes, and new energy every year. There's so much to explore, from art galleries and museums to unique attractions like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Ithaca sits at the heart of a blossoming heritage and craft cider industry. Some of these delicious ciders can be bought in market, but many of the most unique varieties can only be experienced with a visit to Ithaca and this great cider region. Go to visitithaca.com to get inspired and plan your trip today.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Allison Kane, and I'm the host of In the Sauce here on HRN. Now that I'm expanding my cooking school to a sauce line in grocery stores, I need all the help I can get. And I want to help other entrepreneurs build their brands too. You can find In the Sauce wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Tracy Brandt. Tracy is the proprietor of Donkey and Goat in Berkeley, California. Tracy, we ask all our guests to answer five questions. They're the same five questions for everyone.
I should have prepped.
I won't let you because it's spontaneous. Do not fixate or obsess on these. Go quickly.
All right.
First question is, what are you drinking now? And that's in the context of what are you trying? What are you tasting? Is it seasonal? What's interesting you? What's in the fridge? Anything work-related, non-work-related?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to probably be the best at listing specific vintages and producers, but always drinking champagne.
So champagne, top of the list.
Good days, bad days, medium days.
Give me an interest. Is it grower champagne? Do you have a favorite? You know, drop a name or two for me that you like.
I thought you weren't going to make me do that.
You don't have to. Move on to what else you're drinking then.
Certainly, given that it's spring, you know, we're in the process of getting our hands on as much rosé as we can.
You like rosé?
I love rosé.
Okay.
But I drink rosé all year long. Right. But the fact that there's the new vintage makes it kind of exciting time to be drinking rosé.
Okay.
We're working on our Pet Nats, so it's always fun to be tasting other Pet Nats. We're disgorging next week, and we have to decide what we're going to top each one with. So we've been drinking different Pet Nats.
When you say other people's Pet Nats, there's a lot of Pet Nats from Europe, and they're starting to have more brands, you know, come out in the U.S. What are you talking about, both or mostly from here?
Oh, no, both, for sure. I mean, I definitely love focusing on California because of the, especially Northern California, because then there's, you know, similarities in terroir and whatnot that,
right,
that can be gleaned. But certainly to pet nats from all over Australia. I'm definitely have been exploring Australian wines. Australia has done an amazing job of kind of pivoting, I think, from what they were
it's
to what they are now.
Man.
And it's super exciting.
A lot of good stuff.
An amazing array.
All right. So you did good. Champagne, rosé, pet nat. All right. Favorite wine and food pairing. Not something you necessarily eat every night or every month, but what, like, ooh, that's good.
All right, you're gonna laugh, but it's
gonna
be...
No, there's no laughing here.
Well, I'm going to have to say champagne or skin contact whites with fried chicken.
Okay, so I forgot to tell you the Grape Nation rule is you can't say champagne and oysters. But champagne is a big answer, and with fried foods, and fried chicken has come up more than a few times.
It's
so it's
fabulous.
Obviously a fab. People say pizza, popcorn, you know, other things and all that.
We actually have a party every year with fried chicken, and then we do have everybody BYO either skin contact or champagne, and they both work fabulously well.
I interviewed a woman last week, Ariel Arce. She owns Air Champagne Parlor. Before she had that, she owned Birds and Bubbles.
Yep.
So it was a champagne and fried chicken place, obviously.
I know it.
All right. Tracy Brandt's favorite wine restaurant and or bar, probably stick west. You could do New York if you want. I realize this became a tough question because you don't want to leave people out or favor other people, but talk to me about people that have created an environment, you know, for wine or champagne where the selection is there, the knowledge, the vibe. Does anything feel like that to you here or in San Francisco or Napa or wherever you...
Well, favorites, I mean, I'm going to have to say...
For people who do well.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot. But immediately popped in my head is the Punchdown, Lisa and DC. You know, they came out early, and I will disclose Lisa was actually in my cellar in 2009.
It's okay.
But they do a fabulous job at walking the line in what can be a very insular community natural wine. But completely open arms, educational, you know, anybody can walk in there. I can take friends in there.
That makes it a little different. That's what I'm looking
for. It's fantastic. You know,
anything
you don't have
else,
to know wine.
Anything else come to mind?
Well, the Riddler is, of course, champagne.
Okay.
And I hear
Where's
they're
that?
Coming to New York, actually. The Riddler's in San Francisco, Hayes Valley.
Ah.
But I believe they're going to be opening in New York.
Very cool.
Later this year.
All right. Those are good ones. All right. Second to last question. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? Maybe not one, maybe two. I become very redundant in saying the answer used to be based on the rarest or most expensive. It's not that anymore. It's become experiential or, you know, what's a wine, a favorite wine of yours?
Yeah, I'm not going to probably give you a good answer there.
There is no bad answer. Well, maybe you, but go ahead.
No, I mean... I don't know. For me, wine is every day. Wine is community and food. So,
okay. So
I don't
I'll take
like
that.
To
in
turn
the
it
context
into
context of that. What's a favorite wine in that context?
I'm not going to give you an answer. I'm sorry.
Okay. God, are you difficult? I think you may be the only person who have not answered that question. But I will let you go on that. All right. See if you can answer this one. It may be a little harder for you, but not. It sort of skews towards retail. If you had to tell somebody the best wine around $15-$20 retail, a red and a white, like I always say, my kids are in their 20s.
Sure.
They don't want to go to a party with an $8-$9 bottle, and they're not going to spend $45. So if they can come with a cool bottle for $18, $20, $15,
yeah,
you can go category like Muscadet, grape.
Well, I was going to say,
what do you think in your mind? Where's the wine values in a red and a white?
I mean, if I'm going into a bottle shop, I would think, you know, go to the Spanish selection. Go to the used to be the Loire. Loire's gotten a little expensive,
right?
But
so Spanish wines,
Spanish
any
wines,
particular
lots
regions?
Of values. Oh, no.
Okay, so would we put Spanish under reds?
Or whites.
Or whites.
There's some lovely white
right,
wines
I'm
out
gonna
of Spain.
Force you to give me a white.
Greek wines.
Greek wines.
Huge value there.
Huge value
lots
there.
Of,
I agree.
Lots
with
of
that.
Natural wines coming out of Greece these days.
Are a good chunk of the wines from Greece naturally made?
That I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I just know
but
that
there are some that are
that Jenny okay. and my California distributor Amy Atwood both have an increasing number of natural Greek wines that are delicious.
All right, so we're going to answer that question with wines from Spain seem to offer good values. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
And Greek wines were never, you know, expensive. They make expensive ones, but I think you could find some good values.
Absolutely.
I always tell people, go to your favorite wine store, get to know the guy.
That would be my 2 cents.
Ask him to,
exactly.
or her, to do that. All right, admirable job.
Thank you.
B plus, because you didn't finish one question.
You didn't taste my wine.
No. We're getting to that now. All right. So we end our show with a segment called the Weekly Wine Sip, and I'm happy to sit across from you with one of your wines. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our Weekly Wine Sip this week, Tracy was kind enough to bring in one of her wines. It's a 2017 Donkey and Goat white wine from El Dorado, which is the Sierra Nevada. It's the Eliza from the Barzotti Vineyards. Tell me a little more about this wine.
Yeah, so I don't know, somewhere in 2007, 2008, it came high on our list of things to work with or find or plant, being claret. And, you know, we had seen and worked with claret in France. And
Claret is the grape.
Claret is the grape. Not the style.
Right.
Good point.
C-L-A-I-R-E. A-I-R.
Double T-E.
E, right. Claret.
You know, claret de D. Right?
Exactly.
So basically took a number of years to get it out of quarantine. Tablas Creek and Ron Mansfield get it in the ground in 2010. And Ron, our farmer up in El Dorado, had a new project at the Barsotti Vineyard and basically came to several of his clients like us. And Steve Edmonds got a chunk there, Nathan and Duncan, Raj, Jolie Lay. There's a lot of
all the good guys.
All the fun kids. And basically said, what do you want to do with your block? And we said, well, we want to put claret in the ground and we want to make this wine we have in our head that we know we're going to want a kind of purposeful field blend, if you will. We're going to want pickpull because pickpull is the acidity answer to California. We had Vermentino, Grenache Blanc, and Roussanne and some other vineyards, but we wanted to have everything together. So that's what we did. We planted claret, pickpull, Grenache Blanc, Roussanne, and Vermentino at Barsotti, and we made our first vintage in 15.
So that's five different grapes I counted?
Five different grapes.
So the five grapes were grown on that plot?
Grown together in our block,
okay.
Exactly. And not all picked the same day.
Right.
It does vary each vintage. And even if we could get everything in on the same time, we would still vinify some separately just to have some options at the end with blending. We do a little skin contact on this. I mean, it's under 5%, just enough to again, talking about texture, boost up the texture a little bit. We use our version of new oak. We don't have any new oak barrels in our winery, but we do bring in once-used barrels each vintage just to keep...
It's your newest oak.
Exactly.
It's not new oak. It's your newest oak.
Exactly,
okay.
Which still imparts a decent amount of influence.
So this has contact with oak, not old.
A lot. But. The 75% or so is neutral, and then 25% is in those once-used barrels.
Okay.
And yeah, we work pretty hard at this because it's a, you know, a blend that takes months to make. You know, we'll taste and make, you know, the base, and then, you know, kind of taste and tweak it over a good month or so. We bottle it in August, and then we release it, you know, the following April or so.
So tell me a couple things before we evaluate it. So how many cases of this are you making?
This is about 240, 250.
So not easy to find, but it's out there.
It's out there,
restaurants,
for sure.
Restaurants, some better wine stores, New York.
Absolutely.
California, Chicago, and all that. All right, let's give it a sniff and throw it over the tongue and talk about it.
Right.
So color, it's got that beautiful yellowy straw, but a little cloudy because you don't filter a fine.
That's
right?
Correct.
But, you know, cloudy, nice clarity, though. So beautiful color. All right. Both Tracy and I. Tracy's got a cold. I have allergies. So we're going to attempt to give you some
we're
nose.
Really on our game
some
today.
Some nose descriptors
yeah.
here, right?
Sudafed.
What do you get from memory, Tracy?
Well, there's definitely... I think this wine has a lovely minerality. There's an unctuousness, I think, coming from the skin contact. Kind of a little bit of melon even.
Yes. Yes.
There's definitely some citrus notes, some white flowers on the nose typically.
I get citrus, white flower, some of that melon.
Layers in the mid-palate.
Mouthfeel. You said the word unctuous. I don't know if the mouth feels unctuous, but it's very full, right?
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe it as a medium plus? Or
yeah,
full?
I think it's medium plus. I mean, some of it's coming, again, from the touch of skin contact. Some of it's coming from those once-used barrels. And those,
The acidity is right there.
Absolutely.
And does the palate, does the nose transfer to the palate, or do new things pick up on the palate?
You tell me. I mean, I think it transfers pretty
seamlessly. There's nothing so different from the
nose. No, it's not a juxtaposition.
You know, yeah. It's a terrific wine. We're sitting here in the morning, and Tracy made a joke and said, good breakfast wine, and it happens to be a good breakfast wine.
Yeah, we just need some food.
Tracy, what would you pair this with?
Well, last night I paired it with a lovely scallop dish, and it was fantastic.
Now, I've learned it's not necessarily the scallop, but either the sauce or the preparation. So how was it prepared, and what effect did that have?
Oh, that's a good question, and I didn't actually eat it because I was too sick.
Was it creamy? Was it citrusy?
No, it was citrusy.
Okay, yeah, so this is a good match for that because the citrus and the acidity and all of that. So scallops.
But even with the acidity and the skin contact, I mean, it can even stand up to a decent amount of fat as well.
Okay.
I mean, not as much as maybe a Chablis, but certainly.
Right. I agree with that. So this is the 2017 Donkey and Goat White Wine. El Dorado. It's called the Eliza from the Barsotti Vineyard. And it's currently available, right, Tracy?
It is. Just released, actually, in the spring.
Thank you for bringing that in. All right, Tracy, we have to wrap up. Let me just do the show close. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at the hashtag The Grape Nation and at BenRuby. You could subscribe to our Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Like I said earlier, we'll post Tracy's wine list, and we will give you more information on our weekly wine sip, what we drank. I'll post all that on our social, too. Tracy, if we want to find out more about Donkey and Goat wines, what's the best way to do that?
Well, find me on the street, but that's probably hard. So I guess go to our website.
You put yourself out there. So, I mean, you do dinners and tastings.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's potentially a reality. But, I mean, if people want to maybe get on a mailing list or find out more about
it. We have all of that on our website. Absolutely. We have a mailing list and a wine club and a tasting room if you're in Berkeley.
Good point, because people think California wines, Napa, Sonoma. Donkey and Goat is in Berkeley. So if you're in San Francisco, just take a trot right across there. What if people want to follow you and Jared on social media?
We do that too. We have an Instagram account for Donkey and Goat as well as Jared and I personally.
So it's at Donkey and Goat?
At Donkey and Goat.
And tell me about Jared and you if people want to follow.
At Tracy S. Brandt and at Jared R. Brandt.
B-R-A-N-D-T. Okay. All right. I want to thank our guest, Tracy Brandt from Donkey and Goat. I want to thank our engineers at Heritage Radio Network. And I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.